Shell Games by George R. R. Martin. When he'd moved into the dorm back in September, the first thing that Thomas Tudbury had done was tack up his signed photograph of President Kennedy and the tattered 1944 Time cover with Jet Boy as Man of the Year. By November, the picture of Kennedy was riddled with holes from Rodney's darts. Rod had decorated his side of the room with a Confederate flag and a dozen Playboy centerfolds. He hated Jews, niggers, jokers, and Kennedy, and didn't like Tom much either. All through the fall semester, he had fun, covering Tom's bed with shaving cream, short-sheeting him, hiding his eyeglasses, filling his desk drawer with dog turds. On the day that Kennedy was killed in Dallas, Tom came back to his room, fighting to hold the tears. Rod had left him a present. He'd used a red pen. The whole top of Kennedy's head was dripping blood now, and over his eyes Rod had drawn little red X's. His tongue was sticking out of the corner of his mouth. Thomas Tudbury stared at that for a long, long time. He did not cry. He would not allow himself to cry. He began to pack his suitcases. The freshman parking lot was halfway across campus. The trunk on his 54 Mercury had a broken lock, so he tossed the bags into the back seat. He let the car warm up for a long time in the November chill. He must have looked funny sitting there, a short, overweight guy with a crew cut and horn-rimmed glasses, pressing his head against the top of the steering wheel like he was going to be sick. As he was driving out of the lot, he spied Rodney's shiny new Olds Cutlass. Tom shifted to neutral and idled for a moment, considering. He looked around. There was no one in sight. Everybody was inside watching the news. He licked his lips nervously, then looked back at the Oldsmobile. His knuckles whitened around the wheel. He stared hard, furrowed his brow, and squeezed. The door panels gave first, bending inward slowly under the pressure. The headlights exploded with small pops, one after the other. Chrome trim clattered to the ground, and the rear windshield shattered suddenly, glass flying everywhere. Fenders buckled and collapsed, metal squealing in protest. Both rear tires blew at once, the side panels caved in, then the hood. The windshield disintegrated entirely. The crankcase gave, and then the walls of the gas tank, oil, gasoline, and transmission fluid pooled under the car. By then, Tom Tudbury was more confident, and that made it easier. He imagined he had the Olds caught in a huge, invisible fist, a strong fist, and he squeezed all the harder. The crunch of breaking glass and the scream of tortured metal filled the parking lot, but there was no one to hear. He methodically mashed the Oldsmobile into a ball of crushed metal. When it was over, he shifted into gear and left college, Rodney, and childhood behind forever. Somewhere a giant was crying. Tachyon woke disoriented and sick, his hangover throbbing in time to the mammoth sobs. The shapes in the dark room were strange and unfamiliar. Had the assassins come in the night again? Was the family under attack? He had to find his father. He lurched dizzily to his feet, head swimming, and put a hand against the wall to steady himself. The wall was too close. These weren't his chambers. This was all wrong. The smell. And then the memories came back. He would have preferred the assassins. He had dreamed of Takis again, he realized. His head hurt, and his throat was raw and dry. Fumbling in the darkness, he found the chain pull for the overhead light. The bulb swung wildly when he yanked, making the shadows dance. He closed his eyes to still the lurching in his gut. There was a foul taste at the back of his mouth. His hair was matted and filthy, his clothing rumpled. And worst of all, the bottle was empty. Tachyon looked around helplessly. A 6x10 room on the second floor of a lodging house named Rooms, on a street called the Bowery. Confusingly, the surrounding neighborhood had once been called the Bowery too. Angel Face had told him that. But that was before. The area had a different name now. He went to the window, pulling up the shade. The yellow light of a street lamp filled the room. Across the street, the giant was reaching for the moon and weeping because he could not grasp it. Tiny, they called him. Tachyon supposed that was human wit. Tiny would have been 14 feet tall if only he could stand up. His face was unlined and innocent, crowned with a tangle of soft dark hair. His legs were slender and perfectly proportioned. And that was the joke. Slender, perfectly proportioned legs could not begin to support the weight of a 14-foot-tall man. Tiny sat in a wooden wheelchair, a great mechanized thing that rolled through the streets of Jokertown on 4 bald tires from a wrecked semi. When he saw Tack in the window, he screamed incoherently, almost as though he recognized him. Tachyon turned away from the window, shaking. It was another Jokertown night. He needed a drink. His room smelled of mildew and vomit, and it was very cold. Rooms was not as well heated as the hotels he had frequented in the old days. Unbidden, he remembered the Mayflower down in Washington, where he and Blythe... But no, better not to think of that. What time was it, anyway? Late enough. The sun was down, and Jokertown came to life at night. He plucked his overcoat from the floor and slipped it on. Soiled as it was still a marvelous coat, a lovely rich rose color, with fringed golden epaulets on the shoulders and loops of golden braid to fasten the long row of buttons. A musician's coat, the man at the Goodwill had told him. He sat on the edge of his sagging mattress to pull on his boots. The washroom was down at the end of the hall. Steam rose from his urine as it splashed against the rim of the toilet. His hands shook so badly that he couldn't even aim right. He slapped cold, rust-colored water on his face and dried his hands on a filthy towel. Outside, Tack stood for a moment beneath the creaking room's sign, staring at Tiny. He felt bitter and ashamed, and much too sober. There was nothing to be done about Tiny, but he could deal with his sobriety. He turned his back on the weeping giant, slid his hands deep into the pockets of his coat, and walked off briskly down the Bowery. In the alleys, jokers and winos passed brown paper bags from hand to hand and stared with dull eyes at the passers-by. Taverns, pawnbrokers, and mask shops were all doing a brisk trade. The famous Bowery Wildcard Dime Museum, they still called it that, but admission was a quarter now, was closing for the day. Tachyon had gone through it once, 2 years ago, on a day when he was feeling especially guilt-ridden, along with a half-dozen particularly freakish jokers, 20 jars of monstrous joker babies floating in formaldehyde, and a sensational little newsreel about the day of the wild card. The museum had a waxworks display, whose dioramas featured Jet Boy, the Four Aces, a Jokertown orgy, and him. A tour bus rolled past, pink faces pressed to the windows. Beneath the neon light of a neighborhood pizza parlor, 4 youths in black leather jackets and rubber face masks eyed Tachyon with open hostility. They made him uneasy. He averted his eyes and dipped into the mind of the nearest.
Mince and Pansy. Look at that hair dye job. For sure thinks he's in a marching band. Like to beat his fucking drums. But no, wait, shit. There's better. We'll find us a good one tonight. Yeah. Want to get one that squishes when we hit it.
Tack broke the contact with distaste and hurried on. It was old news and a new sport. Come down to the Bowery, buy some masks, beat up a joker. The police didn't seem to care. The Chaos Club and its famous All-Joker Review had the usual big crowd. As Tachyon approached, a long gray limo pulled up to the curb. The doorman, wearing a black tuxedo over luxuriant white fur, opened the door with his tail and helped out a fat man in a dinner jacket. His date was a buxom teenager in a strapless evening gown and pearls, her blonde hair piled high in a bouffant hairdo. A block farther on, a snake lady called out a proposition from the top of a nearby stoop. Her scales were rainbow-colored, glistening.
"Don't be scared, Red," she said.
"It's still soft inside."
He shook his head. The funhouse was housed in a long building with giant picture windows fronting the street, but the glass had been replaced with one-way mirrors. Randall stood out front, shivering in tails and domino. He looked perfectly normal until you noticed that he never took his right hand out of his pocket.
"Hey, Tacky," he called out. "What do you make of Ruby?"
"Sorry, I don't know her," Tachyon said.
Randall scowled.
"No, the guy who killed Oswald."
"Oswald?" Tack said, confused. "Oswald who?"
"Lee Oswald, the guy who shot Kennedy. He got killed on TV this afternoon."
"Kennedy's dead?"
Tachyon said. It was Kennedy who'd permitted his return to the United States, and Tack admired the Kennedys. They seemed almost Takesian. But assassination was part of leadership.
His brothers will avenge him, he said.
Then he recalled that they didn't do things that way on Earth, and besides, this man Ruby had already avenged him, it seemed. How strange that he had dreamed of assassins.
They got Ruby in jail, Randall was saying. If it was me, I'd give the fucker a medal.
He paused.
He shook my hand once, he added. When he was running against Nixon, he came through to give a speech at the Chaos Club. Afterward, when he was leaving, he was shaking hands with everybody.
The doorman took his right hand out of his pocket. It was hard and chitinous, insectile, and in the middle was a cluster of swollen, blind eyes.
He didn't even flinch, Randall said. Smiled and said he hoped I'd remember to vote.
Tachyon had known Randall for a year, but he had never seen his hand before. He wanted to do what Kennedy had done, to grasp that twisted claw, embrace it, shake it. He tried to slide his hand out of the pocket of his coat, but the bile rose in the back of his throat, and somehow all he could do was look away and say,
"He was a good man."
Randall hid his hand again.
"Go inside, Tacky," he said, not unkindly. "Angel Face had to go and see a man, but she told Dez to keep your table open."
Tachyon nodded and let Randall open the door for him. Inside, he gave his coat and shoes to the girl in the check room, a joker with a trim little body whose feathered owl mask concealed whatever the wild card had done to her face. Then he pushed through the interior doors, his stockinged feet sliding with smooth familiarity over the mirrored floor. When he looked down, another Tachyon was staring back up at him, framed by his feet, a grossly fat Tachyon with a head like a beach ball. Suspended from the mirrored ceiling, a crystal chandelier glittered with 100 pinpoint lights, its reflections sparkling off the floor tiles and walls and mirrored alcoves, the silvered goblets and mugs, and even the waiter's trays. Some of the mirrors reflected true, the others were distorting mirrors, funhouse mirrors. When you looked over your shoulder in the funhouse, you could never tell what you'd find looking back. It was the only establishment in Jokertown that attracted jokers and normals in equal numbers. In the funhouse, the normals could see themselves twisted and malformed, and giggle, and play at being jokers. And a joker, if he was very lucky, might glance in the right mirror and see himself as he once had been.
"Your booth is waiting, Dr. Tachyon,"
said Desmond. The maitre d' Dez was a large, florid man, his thick trunk pink and wrinkled, curled around a wine list. He lifted it and beckoned for Tachyon to follow with one of the fingers that dangled from its end.
"Will you be having your usual brand of cognac tonight?"
"Yes,"
Tack said, wishing he had some money for a tip. That night he had his first drink for Blythe, as always, but his second was for John Fitzgerald Kennedy. The rest were for himself. At the end of Hook Road, past the abandoned refinery and the import-export warehouses, past the railroad sidings with their forlorn red boxcars, beneath the highway underpass, past the empty lots full of weeds and garbage, past the huge soybean oil tanks, Tom found his refuge. It was almost dark by the time he arrived, and the engine in the Merc was thumping ominously. But Joey would know what to do about that. The junkyard stood hard on the oily, polluted waters of New York Bay. Behind a 10-foot-high chain-link fence topped with 3 curly strands of barbed wire, a pack of junkyard dogs kept pace with his car, barking a raucous welcome that would have terrified anyone who knew the dogs less well. The sunset gave a strange bronze cast to the mountains of shattered, twisted, rusted automobiles, the acres of scrap metal, the hills and valleys of junk and trash. Finally, Tom came to the wide double gate. On one side, a metal sign warned, "Trespassers, keep out." On the other side, another sign told them to beware of the dogs. The gate was chained and locked. Tom stopped and honked his horn. Just beyond the fence, he could see the 4-room shack that Joey called home. A huge sign was mounted on top of the corrugated tin roof, with yellow spotlights stuck up there to illuminate the letters. It said, "DeAngelis Scrap Metal and Auto Parts." The paint was faded and blistered by 2 decades of sun and rain. The wood itself had cracked, and one of the spots had burned out. Next to the house was parked an ancient yellow dump truck, a tow truck, and, Joey's pride and joy, a blood-red 1959 Cadillac coupe with tail fins like a shark and a monster of a hopped-up engine poking right up through its cutaway hood. Tom honked again. This time he gave it their special signal, tooting out the "Here He Comes to Save the Day" theme from the Mighty Mouse cartoons they'd watched as kids. A square of yellow light spilled across the junkyard as Joey came out with a beer in either hand. They were nothing alike, him and Joey. They came from different stock, lived in different worlds, but they'd been best friends since the day of the third-grade pet show. That was the day he'd found out that turtles couldn't fly, the day he realized what he was and what he could do. Stevie Bruder and Josh Jones had caught him out in the schoolyard. They played catch with his turtles, tossing them back and forth while Tommy ran between them, red-faced and crying. When they got bored, they bounced them off the punchball square chalked on the wall. Stevie's German Shepherd ate one. When Tommy tried to grab the dog, Stevie laid into him and left him on the ground with broken glasses and a split lip. They would have done worse, except for Junkyard Joey, a scrawny kid with shaggy black hair, 2 years older than his classmates, but he'd already been left back twice, couldn't hardly read. And they always said he smelled bad on account of his father, Dom, owned the junkyard. Joey wasn't as big as Stevie Bruder, but he didn't care, that day or any day. He just grabbed Stevie by the back of his shirt and yanked him around and kicked him in the balls. Then he kicked the dog, too, and he would have kicked Josh Jones, except Josh ran away. As he fled, a dead turtle floated off the ground and flew across the schoolyard to smack him in the back of his fat red neck. Joey had seen it happen.
"How'd you do that?"
he said, astonished. Until that moment, even Tommy hadn't realized that he was the reason his turtles could fly. It became their shared secret, the glue that held their odd friendship together. Tommy helped Joey with his homework and quizzed him for tests. Joey became Tommy's protector against the random brutality of playground and schoolyard. Tommy read comic books to Joey until Joey's own reading got so much better that he didn't need Tommy. Dom, a grizzled man with salt-and-pepper hair, a beer belly, and a gentle heart, was proud of that. He couldn't read himself, not even Italian. The friendship lasted through grammar school and high school, and Joey's dropping out. It survived their discovery of girls, weathered the death of Dom DeAngelis, and Tom's family moving off to Perth Amboy. Joey DeAngelis was still the only one who knew what Tom was. Joey popped the cap on another Rheingold with the church key that hung around his neck. Under his sleeveless white undershirt, a beer belly like his father's was growing.
"You're too fucking smart to be doing shit work in a TV repair shop," he was saying.
"It's a job," Tom said. "I did it last summer. I can do it full time. It's not important what kind of job I have. What's important is what I do with my, talent."
"Talent?" Joey mocked.
"You know what I mean, you dumb wop." Tom set his empty bottle down on the top of the orange crate next to the armchair. Most of Joey's furnishings weren't what you'd call lavish. He scavenged them from the junkyard.
"I've been thinking about what Jet Boy said at the end, trying to think what it meant. I figure he was saying that there were things he hadn't done yet. Well, shit, I haven't done anything. All the way back, I asked what I could do for the country, you know? Well, fuck, we both know the answer to that one."
Joey rocked back in his chair, sucking on his Rheingold and shaking his head. Behind him, the wall was lined with the bookshelves that Dom had built for the kids almost 10 years ago. The bottom row was all men's magazines. The rest were comic books. Their comic books. Supermans and Batmans, Action Comics and Detective, the classics illustrateds that Joey had mined for all his book reports, horror comics and crime comics and air war comics, and best of all, their treasure. An almost complete run of Jet Boy comics. Joey saw what he was looking at.
"Don't even think it," he said. "You're no fucking Jet Boy, Tuds."
"No," said Tom. "I'm more than he was. I'm..."
"A dork,"
Joey suggested.
"An ace," he said gravely. "Like the Four Aces."
"They were a colored doo-wop group, weren't they?"
Tom flushed.
"You dumb wop. They weren't singers. They..."
Joey cut him off with a sharp gesture.
"I know who the fuck they were, Tuds. Give me a break.
They were dumb shits, like you. They all went to jail or got shot or something, didn't they? Except for the fucking snitch. What's his name?"
He snapped his fingers.
You know, the guy in Tarzan.
Jack Braun, Tom said. He'd done a term paper on the Four Aces once. And I bet there are others hiding out there, like me. I've been hiding, but no more.
So you figure you're gonna go to the Bayonne Times and give a fucking show?
You asshole. You might as well tell them you're a commie. They'll make you move to Jokertown, and they'll break all the goddamn windows in your dad's house. They might even draft you, asswipe.
No, said Tom. I've got it scoped out. The Four Aces were easy targets. I'm not gonna let them know who I am or where I live.
He used the beer bottle in his hand to gesture vaguely at the bookshelves.
I'm gonna keep my name secret, like in the comics.
Joey laughed out loud.
Fucking A. You gonna wear long johns too, you dumb shit?
God damn it, Tom said. He was getting pissed off.
Shut the fuck up.
Joey just sat there, rocking and laughing.
Come on, big mouth,
Tom snapped, rising.
Get off your fat ass and come outside, and I'll show you just how dumb I am. Come on, you know so damn much.
Joey DeAngelis got to his feet.
This I gotta see.
Outside, Tom waited impatiently, shifting his weight from foot to foot, breath steaming in the cold November air, while Joey went to the big metal box on the side of the house and threw a switch. High atop their poles, the junkyard lights blazed to life. The dogs gathered around, sniffing, and followed them when they began to walk. Joey had a beer bottle poking out of a pocket of his black leather jacket. It was only a junkyard, full of garbage and scrap metal and wrecked cars, but tonight it seemed as magical as when Tommy was 10. On a rise overlooking the black waters of New York Bay, an ancient white Packard loomed like a ghostly fort. That was just what it had been when Joey and he had been kids, their sanctum, their stronghold, their cavalry outpost and space station and castle all rolled into one. It shone in the moonlight, and the waters beyond were full of promise as they lapped against the shore. Darkness and shadows lay heavy in the yard, changing the piles of trash and metal into mysterious black hills with a maze of gray alleys between them. Tom led them into that labyrinth, past the big trash heap where they'd played King of the Mountain and dueled with scrap iron swords, past the treasure troves where they'd found so many busted toys and hunks of colored glass and deposit bottles, and once, even a whole cardboard carton full of comic books. They walked between rows of twisted, rusty cars stacked one on another, Fords and Chevys, Hudsons and DeSotos, a Corvette with a shattered accordion hood, a litter of dead beetles, a dignified black hearse as dead as the passengers it had carried. Tom looked at them all carefully. Finally, he stopped.
That one,
he said, pointing to the remains of a gutted old Studebaker Hawk. Its engine was gone, as were its tires. The windshield was a spider web of broken glass, and even in the darkness they could see where rust had chewed away at the fenders and side panels.
Not worth anything, right?
Joey opened his beer.
Go ahead. It's all yours.
Tom took a deep breath and faced the car. His hands became fists at his side. He stared hard, concentrating. The car rocked slightly. Its front grille lifted an unsteady couple of inches from the ground.
Hoo-wee!
Joey said derisively, punching Tom lightly in the shoulder. The Studebaker dropped with a clang and a bumper fell off.
Shit, I'm impressed, Joey said.
Damn it, keep quiet and leave me alone, Tom said.
I can do it. I'll show you. Just shut your fucking mouth for a minute. I've been practicing. You don't know the things I can do.
Won't say a fucking word,
Joey promised, grinning. He took a swig of his beer. Tom turned back to the Studebaker. He tried to blot out everything, forget about Joey, the dogs, the junkyard. The Studebaker filled his world. His stomach was a hard little ball. He told it to relax, took several deep breaths, let his fists uncurl.
Come on, come on, take it easy. Don't get upset, do it. You've done more than this. This is easy, easy.
The car rose slowly, drifting upward in a shower of rust. Tom turned it around and around, faster and faster. Then, with a triumphant smile, Tom threw it 50 feet across the junkyard. It crashed into a stack of dead Chevys and brought the whole thing down in an avalanche of metal. Joey finished his Rheingold.
Not bad. A few years ago, you could barely lift me over a fence.
I'm getting stronger all the time, Tom said.
Joey DeAngelis nodded and tossed his empty bottle to the side.
Good,
he said. then you won't have any problem with me, will you?
He gave Tom a hard push with both hands. Tom staggered back a step, frowning.
Cut it out, Joey.
Make me, Joey said. He shoved him again, harder. This time Tom almost lost his footing.
Damn it, stop it,
Tom said.
It's not funny, Joey.
No, Joey said. He grinned.
I think it's fucking hilarious. But hey, you can stop me, can't you? Use your damn power.
He moved right up in Tom's face and slapped him lightly across the cheek.
Stop me, Ace,
he said. He slapped him harder.
Come on, Jet Boy, stop me.
The third slap was the hardest yet.
Let's go, Supes, what you waiting for?
The fourth blow had a sharp sting. The fifth snapped Tom's head half around. Joey stopped smiling. Tom could smell the beer on his breath. Tom tried to grab his hand, but Joey was too strong, too fast. He evaded Tom's grasp and landed another slap.
You want a box, Ace? I'll turn you into fucking dog meat, dork, asshole!
The slap almost tore Tom's head off and brought stinging tears to his eyes.
Stop me, Jagoff!
Joey screamed. He closed his hand and buried his fist in Tom's stomach so hard it doubled him over and took his breath away. Tom tried to summon his concentration, to grab and push, but it was the schoolyard all over again. Joey was everywhere, fists raining down on him, and it was all he could do to get his hands up and try to block the blows. And it was no good anyway. Joey was much stronger. He pounded him, pushed him, screaming all the while, and Tom couldn't think, couldn't focus, couldn't do anything but hurt. And he was retreating, staggering back, and Joey came after him, fists cocked, and caught him with an uppercut that landed right on his mouth with a crack that made his teeth hurt. All of a sudden, Tom was lying on his back on the ground with a mouth full of blood. Joey stood over him, frowning.
Fuck,
he said.
I didn't mean to bust your lip.
He reached down, took Tom by the hand, and yanked him roughly to his feet. Tom wiped blood from his lip with the back of his hand. There was blood on the front of his shirt, too.
Oh, look at me. I'm all messed up,
he said with disgust. He glared at Joey.
That wasn't fair. You can't expect me to do anything when you're pounding on me, damn it.
Uh-huh, Joey said.
And while you're concentrating and squinting your eyes, you figure the fucking bad guys are just gonna leave you alone, right?
He clapped Tom across the back.
They'll knock out all your fucking teeth. That's if you're lucky. If they don't just shoot you. You ain't no Jet Boy, Tuds.
He shivered.
Come on. It's fucking cold out here.
When he woke in warm darkness, Tack remembered only a little of the binge, but that was how he liked it. He struggled to sit up. The sheets he was lying on were satin, smooth and sensual, and beneath the odor of stale vomit, he could still smell a faint trace of some flowery perfume. Unsteady, he tossed off the bedclothes and pulled himself to the edge of the four-poster bed. The floor beneath his bare feet was carpeted. He was naked, the air uncomfortably warm on his bare skin. He reached out a hand, found a light switch, and whimpered a little at the brightness. The room was pink and white clutter, with Victorian furnishings and thick soundproofed walls. An oil painting of John F. Kennedy smiled down from above the hearth. In one corner stood a 3-foot-tall plaster statue of the Virgin Mary. Angel Face was seated in a pink wingback chair by the cold fireplace, blinking at him sleepily and covering her yawn with the back of her hand. Tack felt sick and ashamed.
I put you out of your own bed again, didn't I?
He said.
It's all right,
she replied. Her feet were resting on a tiny footstool. Her soles were ugly and bruised, black and swollen despite the special padded shoes she wore. Otherwise, she was lovely. Unbound, her black hair fell to her waist, and her skin had a flushed, radiant quality to it, a warm glow of life. Her eyes were dark and liquid. But the most amazing thing, the thing that never failed to astonish Tachyon, was the warmth in them, the affection he felt so unworthy of. With all he had done to her, and to all the rest of them, somehow this woman called Angel Face forgave and cared. Tack raised a hand to his temple. Someone with a buzzsaw was trying to remove the back of his skull.
My head,
he groaned.
At your prices, the least you could do is take the resins and poisons out of the drinks you sell. Oh, Antekis, we...
I know,
Angel Face said.
On Tacus, you've bred hangovers out of your wines. You told me that one already.
Tachyon gave her a weary smile. She looked impossibly fresh, wearing nothing but a short satin tunic that left her legs bare to the thigh. It was a deep wine red, lovely against her skin. But when she rose, he glimpsed the side of her face, where her cheek had rested against the chair as she slept. The bruise was darkening already, a purple blossom on her cheek.
Angel,
he began.
It's nothing,
she said. She pushed her hair forward to cover the blemish.
Your clothes were filthy. Mal took them out to be cleaned. So you're my prisoner for a while.
How long have I slept?
Tachyon asked.
All day,
Angel Face replied.
Don't worry about it. Once I had a customer get so drunk he slept for 5 months.
She sat down at her dressing table, lifted a phone, and ordered breakfast. Toast and tea for herself, eggs and bacon and strong coffee with brandy for Tachyon, with aspirin on the side.
No,
he protested.
All that food, I'll get sick.
You have to eat. Even spacemen can't live on cognac alone.
Please.
If you want to drink, you'll eat, she said brusquely. That's the deal, remember?
The deal, yes, he remembered. Angel Face provided him with rent money, food, and an unlimited bar tab, as much drink as he'd ever need to wash away his memories. All he had to do was eat and tell her stories. She loved to listen to him talk. He told her family anecdotes, lectured about Takesian customs, filled her with history and legends and romances, with tales of balls and intrigues, and beauty far removed from the squalor of Jokertown. Sometimes, after closing, he would dance for her, tracing the ancient, intricate pavans of Tacus across the nightclub's mirrored floors while she watched and urged him on. Once, when both of them had drunk far too much wine, she talked him into demonstrating the wedding pattern, an erotic ballet that most Takesians danced but once, on their wedding night. That was the only time she had ever danced with him, echoing the steps, hesitantly at first, and then faster and faster, swaying and spinning across the floor until her bare feet were raw and cracked and left wet red smears upon the mirror tiles. In the wedding pattern, the dancing couple came together at the end, collapsing into a long, triumphant embrace. But that was on Tacus. Here, when the moment came, she broke the pattern and shied away from him, and he was reminded once again that Tacus was far away. 2 years before, Desmond had found him unconscious and naked in a Jokertown alley. Someone had stolen his clothing while he slept, and he was fevered and delirious. Dez had summoned help to carry him to the funhouse. When he came to, he was lying on a cot in a back room, surrounded by beer kegs and wine racks.
"Do you know what you were drinking?"
Angel Face had asked him when they'd brought him to her office. He hadn't known. All he recalled was that he'd needed a drink so badly it was an ache inside him, and the old black man in the alley had generously offered to share.
"It's called Sterno,"
Angel Face told him. She had Dez bring in a bottle of her finest brandy.
If a man wants to drink, that's his business. But at least you can kill yourself with a little class.
The brandy spread thin tendrils of warmth through his chest and stopped his hands from shaking. When he'd emptied the snifter, Tack had thanked her effusively. But she drew back when he tried to touch her. He asked her why.
I'll show you,
she had said, offering her hand.
Lightly,
she told him. His kiss had been the merest brush of his lips, not on the back of her hand, but against the inside of her wrist, to feel her pulse, the life current inside her, because she was so very lovely and kind, and because he wanted her. A moment later he'd watched with sick dismay as her skin darkened to purple and then black.
Another one of mine,
he'd thought. Yet somehow they had become friends, not lovers, of course, except sometimes in his dreams. Her capillaries ruptured at the slightest pressure, and to her hypersensitive nervous system, even the lightest touch was painful. A gentle caress turned her black and blue. Lovemaking would probably kill her, but friends, yes. She never asked him for anything he could not give, and so he could never fail her. Breakfast was served by a hunchbacked black woman named Ruth, who had pale blue feathers instead of hair.
"The man brought this for you this morning,"
she told Angel Face after she'd set the table, handing across a thick, square packet wrapped in brown paper. Angel Face accepted it without comment while Tachyon drank his brandy-laced coffee and lifted knife and fork to stare with sick dismay at the implacable bacon and eggs.
"Don't look so stricken," Angel Face said.
"I don't think I've told you about the time the network starship came to Takis, and what my great-grandmother Amurath had to say to the Lebar envoy," he began.
"No," she said. "Go on. I like your great-grandmother."
"That's one of us. She terrifies me," Tachyon said, and launched into the story.
Tom woke well before dawn, while Joey was snoring in the back room. He brewed a pot of coffee in a battered percolator and popped a Thomas English muffin into the toaster. While the coffee perked, he folded the hide-a-bed back into a couch. He covered his muffins with butter and strawberry preserves and looked around for something to read. The comics beckoned. He remembered the day they'd saved them. Most had been his, originally, including the run of Jet Boy he got from his dad. He'd loved those comics. And then one day in 1954, he'd come home from school and found them gone. A full bookcase and two orange crates of funny books vanished. His mother said some women from the PTA had come by to tell her what awful things comic books were. They'd shown her a copy of a book by a Dr. Wortham about how comics turn kids into juvenile delinquents and homos, and how they glorified aces and jokers, and so his mother had let them take Tom's collection. He screamed and yelled and threw a tantrum, but it did no good. The PTA had gathered up comic books from every kid in school. They were going to burn them all Saturday in the schoolyard. It was happening all over the country. There was even talk of a law banning comic books, or at least the kinds about horror and crime and people with strange powers. Wortham and the PTA turned out to be right. That Friday night, on account of comic books, Tommy Tudbury and Joey DeAngelis became criminals. Tom was 9, Joey was 11, but he'd been driving his pop's truck since he was 7. In the middle of the night, he swiped the truck, and Tom snuck out to meet him. When they got to the school, Joey jimmied open a window, and Tom climbed on his shoulders and looked into the dark classroom and concentrated, and grabbed the carton with his collection in it, and lifted it up and floated it out into the bed of the truck. Then he snatched 4 or 5 other cartons for good measure. The PTA never noticed. They still had plenty to burn. If Dom DeAngelis wondered where all the comics had come from, he never said a word. He just built the shelves to hold them, proud as punch of his son who could read. From that day on, it was their collection, jointly. Setting his coffee and muffin on the orange crate, Tom went to the bookcase and took down a couple issues of Jet Boy comics. He reread them as he ate. Jet Boy on Dinosaur Island, Jet Boy and the Fourth Reich, and his favorite, the final issue, the true one, Jet Boy and the Aliens. Inside the cover, the title was 30 Minutes Over Broadway. Tom read it twice as he sipped his cooling coffee. He lingered over some of the best panels. On the last page, they had a picture of the alien Tachyon weeping. Tom didn't know if that had happened or not. He closed the comic book and finished his English muffin. For a long time, he sat there thinking. Jet Boy was a hero. And what was he? Nothing. A wimp. A chicken shit. A fuck of a lot of good his wild card power did anybody. It was useless, just like him. Dispiritedly, he shrugged into his coat and went outside. The junkyard looked raw and ugly in the dawn, and a cold wind was blowing. A few hundred yards to the east, the bay was green and choppy. Tom climbed up to the old Packard on its little hill. The door creaked when he yanked it open. Inside, the seats were cracked and smelled of rot, but at least he was out of that wind. Tom slouched back with his knees up against the dash, staring out at sunrise. He sat unmoving for a long time. Across the yard, hubcaps and old tires floated up in the air and went screaming off to splash into the choppy green waters of New York Bay. He could see the Statue of Liberty on her island, and the hazy outlines of the towers of Manhattan off to the northeast. It was nearly 7:30, his limbs were stiff, and he'd lost count of the number of hubcaps he'd flung, when Tom Tudbury sat up with a strange expression on his face. The icebox he'd been juggling 40 feet from the ground came down with a crash. He ran his fingers through his hair and lifted the icebox again, moved it over 20 yards or so, and dropped it right on Joey's corrugated tin roof. Then he did the same with a tire, a twisted bicycle, 6 hubcaps, and a little red wagon. The door to the house flew open with a bang, and Joey came charging out into the cold, wearing nothing but boxer shorts and a sleeveless undershirt.
He looked real pissed. Tom snatched his bare feet, pulled them out from under him, and dumped him on his butt, hard. Joey cursed. Tom grabbed him and yanked him into the air, upside down.
"Where the fuck are you, Tudbury?"
Joey screamed.
"Cut it out, you dork! Let me down!"
Tom imagined two huge, invisible hands and tossed Joey from one to the other.
"Ah! When I get down, I'm gonna punch you so fucking hard you'll eat through a straw for the rest of your life!"
Joey promised. The crank was stiff from years of disuse, but Tom finally managed to roll down the Packard's window. He stuck his head out.
"Hiya, kids! Hiya, hiya, hiya!"
he croaked, chortling. Suspended 12 feet from the ground, Joey dangled and made a fist.
"I'll pluck your fucking magic twang, you shithead!"
he shouted. Tom yanked off his boxer shorts and hung them from a telephone pole.
"You're gonna die, Tudbury!"
Joey said. Tom took a big breath and set Joey on the ground, very gently. The moment of truth. Joey came running at him, screaming obscenities. Tom closed his eyes, put his hands on the steering wheel, and lifted. The Packard shifted beneath him. Sweat dotted his brow. He shut out the world, concentrated, counted to 10, slowly, backward. When he finally opened his eyes, half expecting to see Joey's fist smashing into his nose, there was nothing to behold but a seagull perched on the hood of the Packard, its head cocked as it peered through the cracked windshield. He was floating. He was flying. Tom stuck his head out of the window. Joey stood 20 feet below him, glaring, hands on his hips and a disgusted look on his face.
"Now!"
Tom yelled down, smiling.
"What was it you were saying last night?"
"I hope you can stay up there all day, you son of a bitch!"
Joey said. He made an ineffectual fist and waved it. Lank black hair fell across his eyes.
"Ah, shit! What does this prove? If I had a gun, you'd still be dead meat!"
"If you had a gun, I wouldn't be sticking my head out the window,"
Tom said.
"In fact, it'd be better if I didn't have a window."
He considered that for a second, but it was hard to think while he was up here. The Packard was heavy.
"I'm coming down,"
he said to Joey.
You calm down?"
Joey grinned.
"Try me and see, Tuds.
Move out of the way. I don't want to squash you with this damn thing."
Joey shuffled to one side, bare ass and goose pimpled, and Tom let the Packard settle as gently as an autumn leaf on a still day. He had the door half open when Joey reached in, grabbed him, yanked him up, and pushed him back against the side of the car, his other hand cocked into a fist.
"Why oughta?"
he began. Then he shook his head, snorted, and punched Tom lightly in the shoulder.
"Give me back my fucking drawers, Ace," he said.
Back inside the house, Tom reheated the leftover coffee.
"I'll need you to do the work,"
he said as he made himself some scrambled eggs and ham and a couple more English muffins. Using his teak always gave him quite an appetite.
"You took auto shop and welding and all that shit. I'll do the wiring."
"Wiring?"
Joey said, warming his hands over his cup.
"What the fuck for?" "The lights and the TV cameras. I don't want any windows people can shoot through. I know where we can get some cameras cheap, and you got lots of old sets around here. I'll just fix them up."
He sat down and attacked his eggs wolfishly.
"I'll need loudspeakers, too. Some kind of PA system, a generator. Wonder if I'll have room for a refrigerator in there."
"The Packard's a big motherfucker," Joey said. "Take out the seats and you'll have room for 3 of the fuckers."
"Not the Packard," Tom said. "I'll find a lighter car. We can cover up the windows with old body panels or something."
Joey pushed hair out of his eyes.
"Fuck the body panels. I got armor plate from the war. They scrapped a bunch of ships at the Navy base in 46 and 47, and Dom put in a bid for the metal and bought us 20 goddamn tons. A fucking waste of money. Who the fuck wants to buy battleship armor? I still got it all, sitting way out back rusting. You need a fucking 16-inch gun to punch through that shit, Tuds? You'll be safe as... fuck, I don't know. Safe, anyhow."
Tom knew.
"Safe," he said loudly, "as a turtle in its shell."
Only 10 shopping days were left until Christmas, and Tack sat in one of the window alcoves, nursing an Irish coffee against the December cold and gazing through the one-way glass at the Bowery. The funhouse wouldn't open for another hour yet, but the back door was always unlocked for Angel Face's friends. Up on stage, a pair of Joker jugglers who called themselves Cosmos and Chaos
were tossing bowling balls around. Cosmos floated 3 feet above the stage in the lotus position, his eyeless face serene. He was totally blind, but he never missed a beat or dropped a ball. His partner, six-armed Chaos, capered around like a lunatic, chortling and telling bad jokes and keeping a cascade of flaming clubs going behind his back with two arms, while the other four flung bowling balls at Cosmos. Tack spared them only a glance. As talented as they were, their deformities pained him. Mal slid into his booth.
"How many of those you had?"
the bouncer demanded, glaring at the Irish coffee. The tendrils that hung from his lower lip expanded and contracted in a blind, worm-like pulsing, and his huge, malformed, blue-black jaw gave his face a look of belligerent contempt.
"I don't see that it's any of your business." "You're no damn use at all, are you?"
"I never claimed I was," Mal grunted.
"You're worth about as much as a sack of shit. I don't see why the hell Angel needs no damn panty-waist spaceman hanging around the place sopping up her booze."
"She doesn't. I told her that."
"Yeah, you can't tell that woman nothing,"
Mal agreed. He made a fist, a very large fist. Before the day of the wild card, he'd been the eighth-ranked heavyweight contender. Afterward, he had climbed as high as third, until they'd banned wild cards from professional sports and wiped out his dreams in a stroke. The measure was aimed at aces, they said, to keep the games competitive. But there had been no exceptions made for jokers. Mal was older now, sparse hair turned iron gray, but he still looked strong enough to break Floyd Patterson over his knee and mean enough to stare down Sonny Liston.
"Look at that,"
he growled in disgust, glaring out the window. Tiny was outside in his chair.
"What the hell is he doing here? I told him not to come by here no more."
Mal started for the door.
"Can't you just leave him alone?"
Takian called after him.
"He's harmless."
"Harmless?"
Mal rounded on him.
"He's screaming, scares off all the fucking tourists. And who the hell's gonna pay for all your free booze?"
But then the door pushed open, and Desmond stood there, overcoat folded over one arm, his trunk half raised.
"Let it be, Ball,"
the maitre d' said wearily.
"Go on now."
Muttering, Mal stalked off. Desmond came over and seated himself in Tachyon's booth.
"Good morning, Doctor," he said.
Tachyon nodded and finished his drink. The whiskey had all gone to the bottom of the cup, and it warmed him on the way down. He found himself staring at the face in the mirrored tabletop. A worn, dissipated, coarse face, eyes reddened and puffy, long red hair tangled and greasy, features distorted by alcoholic bloat. That wasn't him. That couldn't be him. He was handsome, clean-featured, distinguished. His face was... Desmond's trunk snaked out, its fingers locking around his wrist roughly, yanking him forward.
"You haven't heard a word I've said, have you?"
Des said, his voice low and urgent with anger. Blearily, Tack realized that Desmond had been talking to him. He began to mutter apologies.
"Yeah, never mind about that,"
Des said, releasing his grip.
"Listen to me. I was asking for your help, Doctor. I may be a joker, but I'm not an uneducated man. I've read about you. You have certain abilities, let us say."
"No," Tack interrupted. "Not the way you're thinking."
"Your powers are quite well documented," Des said.
"I don't..."
Tack began awkwardly. He spread his hands.
"That was then. I can't. Not anymore."
He stared down at his own wasted features, wanting to look Des in the eye, to make him understand, but unable to bear the sight of the Joker's deformity.
"You made you won't,"
Des said. He stood up.
"I thought that if I spoke to you before we opened, I might actually find you sober. I see I was mistaken. Forget everything I said."
"I'd help you if I could,"
Tack began to say.
"I wasn't asking for me,"
Des said sharply. When he was gone, Tachyon went to the long, silver-chrome bar and got down a full bottle of cognac. The first glass made him feel better. The second stopped his hands from shaking. By the third, he had begun to weep. Mal came over and looked down at him in disgust.
"Never knew no man cried as much as you do,"
he said, thrusting a dirty handkerchief at Tachyon roughly before he left to help them open.
He had been aloft for 4.5 hours when the news of the fire came crackling over the police band radio down by his right foot. Not very far aloft, true, only about 6 feet from the ground, but that was enough. 6 feet or 60, it didn't make all that much difference, Tom had found. 4.5 hours, and he didn't feel the least bit tired yet. In fact, he felt sensational. He was strapped securely into a bucket seat Joey had pulled from a mashed-up Triumph TR3 and mounted on a low pivot right in the center of the VW. The only light was the wan phosphor glow from an array of mismatched television screens that surrounded him on all sides. Between the cameras and their tracking motors, the generator, the ventilation system, the sound equipment, the control panels, the spare box of vacuum tubes, and the little refrigerator, he hardly had space to swing around. But that was okay. Tom was more a claustrophile than a claustrophobe anyway. He liked it in here. Around the exterior of the gutted Beetle, Joey had mounted 2 overlapping layers of thick battleship armor. It was better than a goddamn tank. Joey had already pinged a few shots off it with the Luger that Dom had taken off a German officer during the war. A lucky shot might be able to take out one of his cameras or lights, but there was no way to get to Tom himself inside the shell. He was better than safe. He was invulnerable. And when he felt this secure and sure of himself, there was no limit on what he might be able to do. The shell was heavier than the Packard by the time they'd gotten finished with it, but it didn't seem to matter. 4.5 hours, never touching ground, sliding around silently and almost effortlessly through the junkyard, and Tom hadn't even worked up a sweat. When he heard the report over the radio, a jolt of excitement went through him.
"This is it,"
he thought. He ought to wait for Joey, but Joey had driven to Pompeii Pizza to pick up dinner, pepperoni, onion, and extra cheese, and there was no time to waste. This was his chance. The ring of lights on the bottom of the shell threw stark shadows over the hills of twisted metal and trash as Tom pushed the shell higher into the air, 8 feet up, 10, 12. His eyes flicked nervously from one screen to the next, watching the ground recede. One set, its picture tube filched from an old Sylvania, began a slow vertical roll. Tom played with the knob and stopped it. His palms were sweaty. 15 feet up, he began to creep forward until the shell reached the shoreline. In front of him was darkness. It was too thick a night to see New York, but he knew it was there, if he could reach it. On his small black-and-white screens, the waters of New York Bay seemed even darker than usual. An endless, choppy ocean of ink looming before him. He'd have to grope his way across until the city lights came into sight. And if he lost it out there, over the water, he'd be joining Jet Boy and JFK a lot sooner than he planned. Even if he could unscrew the hatch quick enough to avoid drowning, he couldn't swim. But he wasn't going to lose it, Tom thought suddenly. Why the fuck was he hesitating? He wasn't going to lose it ever again, was he? He had to believe that. He pressed his lips together, pushed off with his mind, and the shell slid smoothly out over the water. The salt waves beneath him rose and fell. He'd never had to push against water before. It felt different. Tom had an instant of panic. The shell rocked and dropped 3 feet before he caught hold of himself and adjusted. He calmed himself with an effort, shoved upward, and rose. High, he thought. He'd come in high. He'd fly in like Jet Boy, like Black Eagle, like a fucking ace. The shell moved out, faster and faster, gliding across the bay with swift serenity as Tom gained confidence. He had never felt so incredibly powerful, so good, so goddamned right. The compass worked fine. In less than 10 minutes, the lights of the Battery and the Wall Street District loomed up before him. Tom pushed still higher and floated uptown, hugging the shoreline of the Hudson. Jetboy's tomb came and went beneath him. He'd stood in front of it 12 times, gazing up at the face of the big metal statue out front. He wondered what that statue might think if it could look up and see him tonight. He had a New York street map, but tonight he didn't need it. The flames could be seen almost 1 mile off. Even inside his armor, Tom could feel the heat waves licking up at him when he made a pass overhead. He carefully began a descent. His fans whirred and the cameras tracked at his command. Below was chaos and cacophony, sirens and shouting. The crowd, the hurrying firemen, the police barricades and the ambulances, big hook and ladder trucks spraying water into the inferno. At first no one noticed him, hovering 50 feet above the sidewalk, until he came in low enough for his lights to play on the walls of the building. Then he saw them looking up, pointing. He felt giddy with excitement.
But he had only an instant to relish the feeling. Then, from the corner of an eye, he saw her in one of his screens. She appeared suddenly in a fifth-floor window, bent over and coughing, her dress already afire. Before he could act, the flames licked at her. She screamed and jumped. He caught her in midair, without thinking, without hesitating, without wondering whether he could do it. He just did it. Caught her and held her and lowered her gently to the ground. The firemen surrounded her, put out her dress, and hustled her into an ambulance. And now Tom saw everyone was looking up at him, at the strange dark shape floating high in the night with its ring of shining lights. The police band was crackling. They were reporting him as a flying saucer, he heard. He grinned. A cop climbed up on top of his police car holding a bullhorn and began to hail him. Tom turned off the radio to hear better over the roar of the flames. He was telling Tom to land and identify himself, asking who he was, what he was. That was easy. Tom turned on his microphone.
"I'm the turtle,"
he said. The VW had no tires. In the wheel wells, Joey had rigged the most humongous speakers they could find, powered by the largest amp on the market. For the first time, the voice of the turtle was heard in the land, a booming, "I'm the turtle!" echoing down the streets and alleys, a rolling thunder crackling with distortion. Except what he said didn't sound quite right. Tom cranked the volume up even higher, injected a little more bass into his voice.
"I am the great and powerful turtle,"
he announced to them all. Then he flew a block west, to the dark, polluted waters of the Hudson, and imagined two huge, invisible hands 40 feet across. He lowered them into the river, cupped them full, and lifted. Rivulets of water dribbled to the street all the way back. When he dropped the first cascade on the flames, a ragged cheering went up from the crowd below.
"Merry Christmas,"
Tack declared drunkenly when the clock struck midnight and the record Christmas Eve crowd began to whoop and shout and pound on the tables. On stage, Humphrey Bogart cracked a lame joke in an unfamiliar voice. All the lights in the house dimmed briefly. When they came back up, Bogart had been replaced by a portly, round-faced man with a red nose.
"Who is he now?"
Tack asked the twin on his left.
"W.C. Fields,"
she whispered. She slid her tongue around the inside of his ear. The twin on the right was doing something even more interesting under the table, where her hand had somehow found a way into his trousers. The twins were his Christmas gift from Angel Face.
"You can pretend they're me,"
she'd told him, though of course they were nothing like her. Nice kids, both of them, buxom and cheerful and absolutely uninhibited, if a bit simple-minded. They reminded him of Takesian sex toys. The one on the right had drawn the wild card, but she wore her cat mask even in bed, and there was no visible deformity to disturb the sweet pleasure of his erection. W.C. Fields, whoever he was, offered some cynical observations about Christmas and small children. The crowd hooted him off the stage. The projectionist had an astonishing array of faces, but he couldn't tell a joke. Tack didn't mind. He had all the diversion he needed.
"Favorite, Doc?"
The vendor thrust a copy of the Herald Tribune across the table with a thick, three-fingered hand. His flesh was blue-black and oily-looking.
"All the Christmas news,"
he said, shifting the clumsy stack of papers under his arm. Two small, curving tusks protruded from the corners of his wide, grinning mouth. Beneath a pork-pie hat, the great bulge of his skull was covered with tufts of bristly red hair. On the streets, they called him the Walrus.
"No, thank you, Jube,"
Tack said with drunken dignity.
"I have no desire to wallow in human folly tonight."
"Hey, look,"
said the twin on the right.
"The turtle."
Tachyon looked around, momentarily befuddled, wondering how that huge armored shell could possibly have gotten inside the funhouse. But of course she was referring to the newspaper.
"You better buy it for her, Tacky,"
the twin on the left said, giggling.
"If you don't, she'll pout."
Tachyon sighed.
"I'll take one, but only if I don't have to listen to any of your jokes, Jube."
"Heard a new one about a Joker, a Polack, and an Irishman stuck on a desert island, but just for that I'm not going to tell it,"
the Walrus replied with a rubbery grin. Tachyon dug for some coins, found nothing in his pockets but a small, feminine hand. Jube winked.
"I'll get it from Dez,"
he said. Tachyon spread the newspaper out on the table, while the club erupted in applause as Cosmos and Chaos made their entrance. A grainy photograph of the turtle was spread across two columns. Tachyon thought it looked like a flying pickle, a big lumpy dill covered with little bumps. The turtle had apprehended a hit-and-run driver who had killed a 9-year-old boy in Harlem, intercepting his flight and lifting the car 20 feet off the ground, where it floated with its engine roaring and its tires spinning madly until the police finally caught up. In a related sidebar, the rumor that the shell was an experimental robot flying tank had been denied by an Air Force spokesman.
You'd think they'd have found something more important to write about by now,
Tachyon said. It was the third big story about the turtle this week. The letter columns, the editorial pages, everything was turtle, turtle, turtle. Even television was rabid with turtle speculation. Who was he? What was he? How did he do it? One reporter had even sought out Tack to ask that question.
Telekinesis, Tack told him. It's nothing new, almost common, in fact.
Teek had been the single ability most frequently manifested by virus victims back in 46. He'd seen a dozen patients who could move paper clips and pencils, and one woman who could lift her own body weight for 10 minutes at a time. Even Earl Sanderson's flight had been telekinetic in origin. What he did not tell them was that Teek on this scale was unprecedented. Of course, when the story ran, they got half of it wrong.
He's a joker, you know,
whispered the twin on the right, the one in the silver-gray cat mask. She was leaning against his shoulder, reading about the turtle.
Joker? Tack said.
He hides inside a shell, doesn't he? Why would he do that unless he was really awful to look at?
She had taken her hand out of his trousers.
Could I have that paper?
Tack pushed it toward her.
They're cheering him now, he said sharply. They cheered the Four Aces, too.
That was a colored group, right?
She said, turning her attention to the headlines.
She's keeping a scrapbook, her sister said. All the jokers think he's one of them. Stupid, huh? I bet it's just a machine, some kind of Air Force flying saucer. He is not, her twin said. It says so right here.
She pointed to the sidebar with a long, red-painted nail.
Never mind about her,
the twin on the left said. She moved closer to Tachyon, nibbling on his neck as her hand went under the table.
Hey, what's wrong? You're all soft.
My pardons.
Tachyon said gloomily. Cosmos and Chaos were flinging axes, machetes, and knives across the stage, the glittering cascade multiplied into infinity by the mirrors around them. He had a bottle of fine cognac at hand, and lovely willing women on either side of him, but suddenly, for some reason he could not have named, it did not feel like such a good night after all. He filled his glass almost to the brim and inhaled the heady alcoholic fumes.
Merry Christmas,
he muttered to no one in particular. Consciousness returned with the angry tones of Mal's voice. Tack lifted his head groggily from the mirrored tabletop, blinking down at his puffy red reflection. The jugglers, the twins, and the crowd were long gone. His cheek was sticky from lying in a puddle of spilled liquor. The twins had jollied him and fondled him, and one of them had even gone under the table for all the good it did. Then Angel Face had come to the table side and sent them away.
Go to sleep, Tacky,
she'd said. Mal had come up to ask if he should lug him back to bed.
Not today,
she'd said.
You know what day this is. Let him sleep it off here.
He couldn't recall when he'd gone to sleep. His head was about to explode, and Mal's shouting wasn't making things any better.
I don't give a flying fuck what you were promised, scumbag. You're not seeing her,
the bouncer yelled. A softer voice said something in reply.
You'll get your fucking money, but that's all you'll get,
Mal snapped. Tack raised his eyes. In the mirrors he saw their reflections darkly, odd twisted shapes outlined in the wan dawn light, reflections of reflections, hundreds of them, beautiful, monstrous, uncountable, his children, his heirs, the offspring of his failures, a living sea of jokers. The soft voice said something else.
Ah, kiss my joker ass,
Mal said. He had a body like a twisted stick and a head like a pumpkin. It made Tack smile. Mal shoved someone and reached behind his back, groping for his gun. The reflections and the reflections of the reflections, the gaunt shadows and the bloated ones, the round-faced ones and the knife-thin ones, the black and the white, They moved all at once, filling the club with noise, a hoarse shout from Mal, the crack of gunfire. Instinctively, Tack dove for cover, cracking his forehead hard on the edge of the table as he slid down. He blinked back tears of pain and lay curled up on the floor, peering out at the reflections of feet while the world disintegrated into a sharp-edged cacophony. Glass was shattering and falling, mirrors breaking on all sides, silvered knives flying through the air, too many for even Cosmos and Chaos to catch. Dark splinters eating into the reflections, taking bites out of all the twisted shadow shapes, blood spattering against the cracked mirrors. It ended as suddenly as it had begun. The soft voice said something, and there was the sound of footsteps, the crunch of glass underfoot. A moment later, a muffled scream from off behind him. Tack lay under the table, drunk and terrified. His finger hurt, bleeding, he saw, sliced open by a sliver of mirror. All he could think of were the stupid human superstitions about broken mirrors and bad luck. He cradled his head in his arms so the awful nightmare would go away. When he woke again, a policeman was shaking him roughly. Mal was dead, one detective told him. They showed him a morgue photo of the bouncer lying in a pool of blood and a welter of broken glass. Ruth was dead too, and one of the janitors, a dim-witted cyclops who had never hurt anyone. They showed him a newspaper. The Santa Claus slaughter, that was what they called it. And the lead was about three jokers who'd found death waiting under the tree on Christmas morning. Miss Fischetti was gone, the other detective told him. Did he know anything about that? Did he think she was involved? Was she a culprit or a victim? What could he tell them about her? He said he didn't know any such person, until they explained that they were talking about Angela Fischetti, and maybe he knew her better as Angel Face. She was gone, and Mal was shot dead, and the most frightening thing of all was that Tack did not know where his next drink was coming from. They held him for 4 days, questioning him relentlessly, going over the same ground again and again, until Tachyon was screaming at them, pleading with him, demanding his rights, demanding a lawyer, demanding a drink. They gave him only the lawyer. The lawyer said they couldn't hold him without charging him, so they charged him with being a material witness, with vagrancy, with resisting arrest, and questioned him again. By the third day, his hands were shaking and he was having waking hallucinations. One of the detectives, the kindly one, promised him a bottle in return for his cooperation. But somehow his answers never quite satisfied them, and the bottle was not forthcoming. The bad-tempered one threatened to hold him forever unless he told the truth.
I thought it was a nightmare,
Tack told them, weeping.
I was drunk, I'd been asleep. No, I couldn't see them, just the reflections, distorted, multiplied. I don't know how many there were. I don't know what it was about. No, she had no enemies. Everyone loved Angel Face. No, she didn't kill Mal. That didn't make sense. Mal loved her. One of them had a soft voice. No, I don't know which one. No, I can't remember what they said. No, I don't know if they were jokers or not. They look like jokers, but the mirrors distort. Some of them, not all of them, don't you see? No, I couldn't possibly pick them out of a lineup. I never really saw them. I had to hide under the table. Don't you see? The assassins had come. That's what my father always told me. There wasn't anything I could do.
When they realized that he was telling them all he knew, they dropped the charges and released him to the dark streets of Jokertown and the cold of the night. He walked down the Bowery alone, shivering. The walrus was hawking the evening papers from his newsstand on the corner of Hester.
"Read all about it,"
he called out.
"Turtle terror in Jokertown."
Tachyon paused to stare dully at the headlines. "Police seek turtle," the Post reported. "Turtle charged with assault," announced the World Telegram. So the cheering had stopped already. He glanced at the text. The turtle had been prowling Jokertown the past 2 nights, lifting people 100 feet in the air to question them, threatening to drop them if he didn't like their answers. When police tried to make an arrest last night, the turtle had deposited 2 of their black and whites on the roof of Freakers at Chatham Square. "Curb the turtle," the editorial in the World Telegram said.
"You all right, Doc?"
the walrus asked.
"No,"
said Tachyon, putting down the paper. He couldn't afford to pay for it anyway. Police barriers blocked the entrance to the funhouse, and a padlock secured the door. "Closed indefinitely," the sign said. He needed a drink, but the pockets of his bandleader's coat were empty. He thought of Dez and Randall and realized that he had no idea where they lived or what their last names might be. Trudging back to rooms, Tack climbed wearily up the stairs. When he stepped into the darkness, he had just enough time to notice that the room was frigidly cold. The window was open, and a bitter wind was scouring out the old smells of urine, mildew, and drink. Had he done that? Confused, he stepped toward it, and someone came out from behind the door and grabbed him. It happened so fast he scarcely had time to react. The forearm across his windpipe was an iron bar, choking off his scream, and a hand wrenched his right arm up behind his back hard. He was choking, his arm close to breaking, and then he was being shoved toward the open window, running at it, and Tachyon could only thrash feebly in a grip much stronger than his own. The windowsill caught him square in the stomach, knocking the last of his breath right out of him, and suddenly he was falling, head over heels, locked helplessly in the steel embrace of his attacker, both of them plunging toward the sidewalk below. They jerked to a stop, 5 feet above the cement, with a wrench that elicited a grunt from the man behind him. Tack had closed his eyes before the instant of impact. He opened them as they began to float upward. Above the yellow halo of the street lamp was a ring of much brighter lights, set in a hovering darkness that blotted out the winter stars. The arm across his throat had loosened enough for Tachyon to groan.
"Ew,"
he said hoarsely, as they curved around the shell and came to rest gently on top of it. The metal was icy cold, its chill biting right through the fabric of Tachyon's pants. As the turtle began to rise straight up into the night, Tachyon's captor released him. He drew in a shuddering breath of cold air and rolled over to face a man in a zippered leather jacket, black dungarees, and a rubbery green frog mask.
"Who?"
he gasped.
"I'm the great and powerful turtle's mean-ass sidekick,"
the man in the frog mask said rather cheerfully.
"Dr. Tachyon, I presume,"
boomed the shell's speakers, far above the alleys of Jokertown.
"I've always wanted to meet you. I read about you when I was just a kid."
"Oh, turn it down,"
Tack croaked weakly.
"Oh, sure. Is that better?"
The volume diminished sharply.
"It's noisy in here, and behind all this armor, I can't always tell how loud I sound. I'm sorry if we scared you, but we couldn't take the chance of you saying no. We need you."
Tack stayed just where he was, shivering, shaken.
"What do you want?"
he asked wearily.
"Help,"
the turtle declared. They were still rising, the lights of Manhattan spread out all around them, and the spires of the Empire State Building and the Chrysler Building rose uptown. They were higher than either. The wind was cold and gusting. Tack clung to the shell for dear life.
"Leave me alone,"
Tachyon said.
"I have no help to give you. I have no help to give anybody."
"Fuck, he's crying,"
the man in the frog mask said.
"You don't understand,"
the turtle said. The shell began to drift west, its motion silent and steady. There was something awesome and eerie about the flight.
"You have to help. I've tried on my own, but I'm getting nowhere. But you, your powers, they can make the difference."
Tachyon was lost in his own self-pity, too cold and exhausted and despairing to reply.
"I want a drink,"
he said.
"Fuck it,"
said Frogface.
"Dumbo was right about this guy. He's nothing but a goddamn wino."
"He doesn't understand," said the turtle. "Once we explain, he'll come around. Dr. Tachyon, we're talking about your friend, Angel Face."
He needed a drink so badly it hurt.
"She was good to me,"
he said, remembering the sweet perfume of her satin sheets and her bloody footprints on the mirror tiles.
"But there's nothing I can do. I told the police everything I know."
"Chicken shit, asshole,"
said Frogface.
"When I was a kid, I read about you in Jet Boy Comics,"
the turtle said.
30 minutes over Broadway, remember? You were supposed to be as smart as Einstein. I might be able to save your friend Angel Face, but I can't without your powers."
"I don't do that any longer. I can't. There was someone I hurt, someone I cared for, but I seized her mind just for an instant, for a good reason, or at least I thought it was for a good reason, but it destroyed her. I can't do it again."
"Boo-hoo," said Frogface mockingly. "Let's toss him, Turtle. He's not worth a bucket of warm piss."
He took something out of one of the pockets of his leather jacket. Tack was astonished to see that it was a bottle of beer.
"Please,"
Tachyon said, as the man popped off the cap with the bottle opener hung around his neck.
A sip,
Tack said.
Just a sip.
He hated the taste of beer, but he needed something, anything. It had been days.
Please?
Fuck off, Frogface said.
Tachyon, said the turtle. You can make him.
No, I can't,
Tack said. The man raised the bottle up to green rubber lips.
I can't,
Tack repeated. Frogface continued to drink.
No.
He could hear it gurgling.
Please, just a little.
The man lowered the beer bottle, sloshed it thoughtfully. Just a swallow left, he said.
Please.
He reached out, hands trembling. Nah, said Frogface. He began to turn the bottle upside down.
Course, if you're really thirsty, you could just grab my mind, right? Make me give you the fucking bottle.
He tipped the bottle a little more.
Go on. I dare you. Try it.
Tack watched the last mouthful of beer dribble down onto the turtle's shell and run off into empty air.
Fuck, said the man in the frog mask. You got it bad, don't you?
He pulled another bottle from his pocket, opened it, and handed it across. Tack cradled it with both hands. The beer was cold and sour, but he had never tasted anything half so sweet. He drained it all in one long swallow.
Got any other smart ideas?
Frogface asked the turtle. Ahead of them was the blackness of the Hudson River, the lights of Jersey off to the west. They were descending. Beneath them, overlooking the Hudson, was a sprawling edifice of steel and glass and marble that Tachyon suddenly recognized, though he had never set foot inside it. Jet Boy's tomb.
Where are we going?
He asked.
We're going to see a man about a rescue,
the turtle said. Jet Boy's tomb filled the entire block, on the site where the pieces of his plane had come raining down. It filled Tom's screens, too, as he sat in the warm darkness of his shell, bathed in a phosphor glow. Motors whirred as the cameras moved in their tracks. The huge flanged wings of the tomb curved upward, as if the building itself was about to take flight. Through tall, narrow windows, he could see glimpses of the full-size replica of the JB-1, suspended from the ceiling, its scarlet flanks aglow from hidden lights. Above the doors, the hero's last words had been carved, each letter chiseled into the black Italian marble and filled with stainless steel. The metal flashed as the shell's white-hot spots slid across the legend. I can't die yet. I haven't seen the Jolson story. Tom brought the shell down in front of the monument to hover 5 feet above the broad marble plaza at the top of the stairs. Nearby, a 20-foot-tall steel Jet Boy looked out over the West Side Highway and the Hudson beyond, his fists cocked. The metal used for the sculpture had come from the wreckage of crashed planes, Tom knew. He knew that statue's face better than he knew his father's. The man they'd come to meet emerged from the shadows at the base of the statue, a chunky dark shape huddled in a thick overcoat, hands shoved deep into his pockets. Tom shone a light on him, a camera track to give him a better view. The Joker was a portly man, round-shouldered and well-dressed. His coat had a fur collar and his fedora was pulled low. Instead of a nose, he had an elephant's trunk in the middle of his face. The end of it was fringed with fingers, snug in a little leather glove. Dr. Tachyon slid off the top of the shell, lost his footing, and landed on his ass. Tom heard Joey laugh. Then Joey jumped down too and pulled Tachyon to his feet. The Joker glanced down at the alien.
So, you convinced him to come after all. I'm surprised.
We were real fucking persuasive, Joey said.
Dez,
Tachyon said, sounding confused.
What are you doing here? Do you know these people?
Elephant Face twitched his trunk.
Since the day before yesterday, yes, in a manner of speaking. They came to me. The hour was late, but a phone call from the great and powerful turtle does pique one's interest. He offered his help, and I accepted. I even told them where he lived.
Tachyon ran a hand through his tangled, filthy hair.
I'm sorry about Mal. Do you know anything about Angel Face? Do you know how much she meant to me?
In dollars and cents, I know quite precisely, Dez said.
Tachyon's mouth gaped open. He looked hurt. Tom felt sorry for him.
I wanted to go to you, he said. I didn't know where to find you.
Joey laughed.
Ha! He's listed in the fucking phone book, dork. Ain't that many guys named Xavier Desmond? He looked at the shell. How the fuck is he gonna find the lady if he couldn't even find his buddy here?
Desmond nodded.
An excellent point. This isn't going to work. Just look at him.
His trunk pointed.
What good is he? We're wasting precious time.
We did it your way, Tom replied. We're getting nowhere. No one's talking. He can get the information we need.
I don't understand any of this,
Tachyon interrupted. Joey made a disgusted sound. He had found a beer somewhere and was cracking the cap.
What's happening?
Tack asked.
If you had been the least bit interested in anything besides cognac and cheap tarts, you might know,
Dez said icily.
Tell him what you told us,
Tom commanded. When he knew, Tachyon would surely help, he thought. He had to. Dez gave a heavy sigh.
Angel Face had a heroin habit. She hurt, you know? Perhaps you noticed that from time to time, Doctor. The drug was the only thing that got her through the day. Without it, the pain would have driven her insane. Nor was hers an ordinary junkie's habit. She used uncut heroin in quantities that would have killed any normal user. You saw how minimally it affected her. The Joker metabolism is a curious thing. Do you have any idea how expensive heroin is, Dr. Tachyon? Oh, never mind. I see that you don't. Angel Face made quite a bit of money from the funhouse, but it was never enough. Her source gave her credit until she was in far over her head, then demanded, call it a promissory note, or a Christmas present. She had no choice. It was that or be cut off. She hoped to come up with the money, being an eternal optimist. She failed. On Christmas morning, her source came by to collect. Mal wasn't about to let him have her. They insisted.
Tachyon was squinting in the glare of the lights. His image began to roll upward.
Why didn't she tell me?
He said.
I suppose she didn't want to burden you, Doctor. It might have taken the fun out of your self-pitying binges.
Have you told the police?
The police? Oh, yes, New York's finest. The ones who seem so curiously uninterested whenever a Joker is beaten or killed, yet ever so diligent if a tourist is robbed. The ones who so regularly arrest, harass, and brutalize any Joker who has the poor taste to live anywhere outside of Jokertown. Perhaps we might consult the officer who commented that raping a Joker woman is more a lapse in taste than a crime.
Dez snorted.
Dr. Tachyon, where do you think Angel Face bought her drugs? Do you think any ordinary street pusher would have access to uncut heroin in the quantity she needed? The police were her source. The head of the Jokertown Narcotics Squad, if you care to be precise. Oh, I'll grant you that it's unlikely the whole department is involved. Homicide may be conducting a legitimate investigation. What do you think they'd say if we told them that Bannister was the murderer? You think they'd arrest one of their own? On the strength of my testimony or the testimony of any Joker?
We'll make good her note,
Tachyon blurted.
We'll give this man his money, or the funhouse, or whatever it is he wants.
The promissory note, Desmond said wearily, was not for the funhouse.
Whatever it was, give it to him.
She promised him the only thing she still had that he wanted, Desmond said. Herself. Her beauty and her pain. The word's out on the street, if you know how to listen. There's going to be a very special New Year's Eve party somewhere in the city. Invitation only. Expensive. A unique thrill. Bannister will have her first. He's wanted that for a long time. But the other guests will have their turn. Jokertown hospitality.
Tachyon's mouth worked soundlessly for a moment.
The police?
He finally managed. He looked as shocked as Tom had been when Desmond told him and Joey.
Do you think they love us, Doctor? We're freaks. We're diseased. Jokertown is a hell, a dead end. And the Jokertown police are the most brutal, corrupt, and incompetent in the city. I don't think anyone planned what happened at the funhouse, but it happened. And Angel Face knows too much. They can't let her live, so they're gonna have some fun with the Joker cunt.
Tom Tudbury leaned toward his microphone.
I can rescue her, he said. These fuckers haven't seen anything like the great and powerful Turtle. But I can't find her.
Dez said.
She has a lot of friends, but none of us can read minds or make a man do something he doesn't want to.
I can't,
Tachyon protested. He seemed to shrink into himself, to edge away from them, and for an instant Tom thought the little man was going to run away.
You don't understand.
What a fucking candy ass,
Joey said loudly. Watching Tachyon crumble on his screens, Tom Tudbury finally ran out of patience.
If you fail, you fail, he said. And if you don't try, you fail too. So what the fuck difference does it make? Jet Boy failed, but at least he tried. He wasn't an ace. He wasn't a goddamn Takesian. He was just a guy with a jet, but he did what he could.
I want to. I just can't.
Dez trumpeted his disgust. Joey shrugged. Inside his shell, Tom sat in stunned disbelief. He wasn't going to help. He hadn't believed it, not really. Joey had warned him, Desmond too, but Tom had insisted. He'd been sure. This was Dr. Tachyon. Of course he'd help. Maybe he was having some problems, but once they explained the situation to him, once they made it clear what was at stake and how much they needed him, he had to help. But he was saying no. It was the last goddamn straw. He twisted the volume knob up all the way.
You son of a bitch!
He boomed, and the sound hammered out over the plaza. Tachyon flinched away.
You no-good fucking little alien chicken shit!
Tachyon stumbled backward down the stairs, but the turtle drifted after him, loudspeakers blaring.
It was all a lie, wasn't it? Everything in the comic books, everything in the papers, it was all a stupid lie! All my life they beat me up and they called me a fucking wimp and a coward, but you're the coward, you asshole, you shitty little whiner. You won't even try. You don't give a damn about anybody, about your friend, Angel Face, or about Kennedy or Jet Boy or anybody. You have all these fucking powers and you're nothing. You won't do anything. You're worse than Oswald or Braun or any of them.
Tachyon staggered down the steps, hands over his ears, shouting something unintelligible, but Tom was past listening. His anger had a life of its own now. He lashed out, and the alien's head snapped around and reddened with the force of the slap.
Asshole!
Tom was shrieking.
You're the one in a shell!
Invisible blows rained down on Tachyon in a fury. He reeled, fell, rolled a third of the way down the stairs, tried to get back to his feet. He was bowled over again and bounced down to the street head over heels.
Asshole!
The turtle thundered.
Run, you shithead! Get out of here, or I'll throw you in the damned river! Run, you little wimp, before the great and powerful turtle really gets upset! Run, damn it! You're the one in the shell! You're the one in the shell!
And he ran, dashing blindly from one streetlight to the next, until he was lost in the shadows. Tom Tudbury watched him vanish on the shell's array of television screens. He felt sick and beaten. His head was throbbing. He needed a beer, or an aspirin, or both. When he heard the sirens coming, he scooped up Joey and Desmond and set them on top of his shell, killed his lights, and rose straight up into the night, high, high up, into the darkness and cold and silence. That night, Tack slept the sleep of the damned, thrashing about like a man in a fever dream, crying out, weeping, waking again and again from nightmares, only to drift back into them. He dreamt he was back on Takis, and his hated cousin Zab was boasting about a new sex toy. But when he brought her out, it was Blythe, and he raped her right there in front of him. Tak watched it all, powerless to intervene. Her body writhed beneath his, and blood flowed from her mouth and ears and vagina. She began to change into a thousand Joker shapes, each more horrible than the last. And Zab went right on, raping them all as they screamed and struggled. But afterward, when Zab rose from the corpse covered with blood, it wasn't his cousin's face at all. It was his own, worn and dissipated, a coarse face, eyes reddened and puffy, long red hair tangled and greasy, features distorted by alcoholic bloat, or perhaps by a funhouse mirror. He woke around noon to the terrible sound of Tiny weeping outside his window. It was more than he could stand. It was all more than he could stand. He stumbled to the window and threw it open and screamed at the giant to be quiet, to stop, to leave him alone, to give him peace, please. But Tiny went on and on. So much pain, so much guilt, so much shame. Why couldn't they let him be? He couldn't take it anymore. No, shut up, please, shut up. And suddenly Tack shrieked and reached out with his mind and plunged into Tiny's head and shut him up. The silence was thunderous. The nearest phone booth was in a candy store a block down. Vandals had ripped the phone book to shreds. He dialed information and got the listing for Xavier Desmond on Christie Street, only a short walk away. The apartment was a fourth-floor walk-up above a mask shop. Tachyon was out of breath by the time he got to the top. Des opened the door on the fifth knock.
"You,"
he said.
"The turtle," Tack said. His throat was dry. "Did he get anything last night?"
"No," Desmond replied. His trunk twitched. "The same story as before. They're wise to him now. They know he won't really drop them. They call his bluff. Short of actually killing someone, there's nothing to do."
"Tell me who to ask," Tack said.
"You?"
Des said. Tack could not look the Joker in the eye. He nodded.
"Let me get my coat," Des said.
He emerged from the apartment bundled up for the cold, carrying a fur cap and a frayed beige raincoat.
"Put your hair up in the hat," he told Tachyon, "and leave that ridiculous coat here. You don't want to be recognized."
Tack did as he said. On the way out, Des went into the mask shop for the final touch.
"A chicken,"
Tack said when Des handed him the mask. It had bright yellow feathers, a prominent orange beak, a floppy red coxcomb on top.
"I saw it and I knew it was you," said Des. "Put it on."
A large crane was moving into position at Chatham Square to get the police cars off Freaker's roof. The club was open. The doorman was a 7-foot-tall, hairless Joker with fangs. He grabbed Des by the arm as they tried to pass under the neon thighs of the 6-breasted dancer who writhed on the marquee.
"No jokers allowed," he said brusquely. "Get lost, Tusker."
"Reach out and grab his mind,"
Tachyon thought. Once, before Blythe, he would have done it instinctively, but now he hesitated, and hesitating, he was lost. Des reached into his back pocket, pulled out a wallet, and extracted a $50 bill.
"You were watching them lower the police cars," he said. "You never saw me pass."
"Oh, yeah," the doorman said. The bill vanished in a clawed hand. "Real interesting, them cranes."
"Sometimes money is the most potent power of all,"
Des said as they walked into the cavernous dimness within. A sparse noontime crowd sat eating the free lunch and watching a stripper gyrate down a long runway behind a barbed wire barrier. She was covered with silky gray hair, except for her breasts, which had been shaved bare. Desmond scanned the booths along the far wall. He took Tack's elbow and led him to a dark corner where a man in a peacoat was sitting with a stein of beer.
"They letting jokers in here now?"
the man asked gruffly as they approached. He was saturnine and pockmarked. Tack went into his mind.
"Fuck, what's this now? The elephant man's from the funhouse. Who's the other one? Damn jokers anyhow. Got a lot of nerve."
"Where's Bannister keeping Angel Face?"
Des asked.
"Angel Face is the slit at the funhouse, right? Don't know no Bannister. Is this a game? Fuck off, Joker, I ain't playing."
In his thoughts, images came tumbling. Tack saw mirrors shattering, silver knives flying through the air. Felt Miles shove and saw him reach back for a gun, watched him shudder and spin as the bullets hit, heard Bannister's soft voice as he told them to kill Ruth, saw the warehouse over on the Hudson where they were keeping her, the livid bruises on her arm when they'd grabbed her, tasted the man's fear, fear of jokers, fear of discovery, fear of Bannister, the fear of them. Tack reached out and squeezed Desmond's arm. Des turned to go.
"Hey, hold it right there,"
the man with the pockmarked face said. He flashed a badge as he unfolded from the booth.
"Undercover narcotics," he said.
"And you've been using, mister, asking asshole junkie questions like that."
Des stood still as the man frisked him down.
"Well, look at this,"
he said, producing a bag of white powder from one of Desmond's pockets.
"Wonder what this is."
"You're under arrest, freak face."
"That's not mine," Desmond said calmly.
"The hell it ain't,"
the man said, and in his mind the thoughts ran one after another.
"Little accident resisting arrest. What could I do, huh? Jokers will scream, but who listens to a fucking joker? Only what am I gonna do with the other one?"
And he glanced at Tachyon.
"Jeez, look at the chicken man's shaking. Maybe the fucker is using. That'd be great."
Trembling, Tack realized the moment of truth was at hand. He was not sure he could do it. It was different than with Tiny. That had been blind instinct, but he was awake now, and he knew what he was doing. It had been so easy once, as easy as using his hands. But now those hands trembled, and there was blood on them, and on his mind as well. He thought of Blythe, and the way her mind had shattered under his touch, like the mirrors in the funhouse. And for a terrible long second, nothing happened, until the fear was rank in his throat, and the familiar taste of failure filled his mouth. Then the pock-faced man smiled an idiot's smile, sat back down in his booth, laid his head on the table, and went to sleep as sweetly as a child. Dez took it in stride.
You're doing?
Tachyon nodded.
You're shaking,
Dez said.
Are you all right, doctor?
I think so,
Tachyon said. The policeman had begun to snore loudly.
I think maybe I am all right, Dez. For the first time in years.
He looked at the Joker's face, looked past the deformity to the man beneath.
I know where she is,
he said. They started toward the exit. In the cage, a full-breasted, bearded hermaphrodite had started into a bump and grind.
We'll have to move quickly.
In an hour I could get together 20 men.
No, Tachyon said. The place they're holding her isn't in Jokertown.
Dez stopped with his hand on the door.
I see, he said. And outside of Jokertown, Jokers and masked men are rather conspicuous, aren't they?
Exactly,
Tack said. He did not voice his other fear, of the retribution that would surely be enacted should Jokers dare to confront police, even police as corrupt as Bannister and his cohorts. He would take the risk himself. He had nothing left to lose, but he could not permit them to take it.
Can you reach the turtle?
He asked.
I could take you to him,
Dez replied.
When?
Now,
Thack said. In an hour or two, the sleeping policeman would awaken and go straight to Bannister, and say what? That Dez and a man in a chicken mask had been asking questions? That he'd been about to arrest them, but suddenly he'd gotten very sleepy? Would he dare admit to that? If so, what would Bannister make of it? Enough to move Angel Face? Enough to kill her? They could not chance it. When they emerged from the dimness of Freakers, the crane had just lowered the second police car to the sidewalk. A cold wind was blowing, but behind his chicken feathers, Dr. Tachyon had begun to sweat. Tom Tudbury woke to the dim, muffled sound of someone pounding on his shell. He pushed aside the frayed blanket and bashed his head sitting up.
Oh, God damn it!
He cursed, fumbling in the darkness until he found the map light. The pounding continued, a hollow boom, 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 against the armor, echoing. Tom felt a stab of panic.
The police, he thought. They've found me. They've come to drag me out and haul me up on charges.
His head hurt. It was cold and stuffy in here. He turned on the space heater, the fans, the cameras. His screens came to life. Outside was a bright, cold December day, the sunlight painting every grimy brick with stark clarity. Joey had taken the train back to Bayonne, but Tom had remained. They were running out of time. He had no other choice. Dez found him a safe place, an interior courtyard in the depths of Jokertown, surrounded by decaying five-story tenements, its cobblestones redolent with the smell of sewage, wholly hidden from the street. When he'd landed, just before dawn, lights had blinked on in a few of the dark windows, and faces had come to peer cautiously around the shades, wary, frightened, not quite human faces, briefly seen and gone as quickly, when they decided that the thing outside was none of their concern. Yawning, Tom pulled himself into his seat and panned his cameras until he found the source of the commotion. Dez was standing by an open cellar door, arms crossed, while Dr. Tachyon hammered on the shell with a length of broom handle. Astonished, Tom flipped on his microphones.
You!
Tachyon winced.
Oh, please!
He lowered the volume.
Sorry, you took me by surprise. I never expected to see you again. After last night, I mean. I didn't hurt you, did I? I didn't mean to, I understand,
Tachyon said.
But we've got no time for recriminations or apologies now.
Dez began to roll upward. Damn, that vertical hold.
We know where they have her, the Joker said as his image flipped. That is, if Dr. Tachyon can indeed read minds as advertised.
Where?
Tom said. Dez continued to flip, flip, flip.
A warehouse on the Hudson,
Tachyon replied.
Near the foot of the pier. I can't tell you an address, but I saw it clearly in his thoughts.
I'll recognize it. Great, Tom enthused.
He gave up on his efforts to adjust the vertical hold and whapped the screen. The picture steadied.
Then we've got them. Let's go.
The look on Tachyon's face took him aback.
You are coming, aren't you?
Tachyon swallowed.
Yes, he said.
He had a mask in his hand. He slipped it on. That was a relief, Tom thought. For a second there, he thought he'd have to go it alone.
Climb on, he said.
With a deep sigh of resignation, the alien scrambled on top of the shell, his boots scrabbling at the armor. Tom gripped his armrest tightly and pushed up. The shell rose as steadily as a soap bubble. He felt elated. This was what he was meant to do, Tom thought. Jet Boy must have felt like this. Joey had installed a monster of a horn in the shell. Tom let it rip as they floated clear of the rooftops, startling a coop of pigeons, a few winos, and Tachyon with the distinctive blare of, "Here I come to save the day."
It might be wise to be a bit more subtle about this,
Tachyon said diplomatically. Tom laughed.
I don't believe it. I got a man from outer space who mostly dresses like Pinky Lee riding on my back, and he's telling me I ought to be subtle.
He laughed again as the streets of Jokertown spread out all around them. They made their final approach through a maze of waterfront alleys. The last was a dead end, terminating in a brick wall scrawled over with the names of gangs and young lovers. The turtle rose above it, and they emerged in the loading area behind the warehouse. A man in a short leather jacket sat on the edge of the loading dock. He jumped to his feet when they hove into view. His jump took him a lot higher than he'd anticipated, about 10 feet higher. He opened his mouth, but before he could shout, Tack had him. He went to sleep in midair. The turtle stashed him atop a nearby roof. 4 wide loading bays opened onto the dock, all chained and padlocked, their corrugated metal doors marked with wide brown streaks of rust. Trespassers will be prosecuted, said the lettering on the narrow door to the side. Tack hopped down, landing easily on the balls of his feet, his nerves tingling.
I'll go through, he told the turtle. Give me a minute, and then follow.
A minute, the speaker said.
You got it.
Tack pulled off his boots, opened the door just a crack, and slid into the warehouse on purple-stockinged feet, summoning up all the stealth and fluid grace they'd once taught him on Tacus. Inside, bales of shredded paper, bound tightly in thin wire, were stacked 20 and 30 feet high. Tachyon crept down a crooked aisle toward the sound of voices. A huge yellow forklift blocked his path. He dropped flat and squirmed underneath it to peer around one massive tire. He counted 5 altogether. 2 of them were playing cards, sitting in folding chairs and using a stack of coverless paperbacks for a table. A grossly fat man was adjusting a gigantic paper-shredding machine against the far wall. The last 2 stood over a long table, bags of white powder piled in neat rows in front of them. The tall man in the flannel shirt was weighing something on a small set of scales. Next to him, supervising, was a slender, balding man in an expensive raincoat. He had a cigarette in his hand, and his voice was smooth and soft. Tachyon couldn't quite make out what he was saying. There was no sign of Angel Face. He dipped into the sewer that was Bannister's mind and saw her, between the shredder and the baling machine. He couldn't see it from under the forklift. The machinery blocked the line of sight, but she was there. A filthy mattress had been tossed on the concrete floor, and she lay atop it, her ankles swollen and raw where the handcuffs chafed against her skin.
58 hippopotami, 59 hippopotami, 60 hippopotami,
Tom counted. The loading bays were big enough. He squeezed, and the padlock disintegrated into shards of rust and twisted metal. The chains came clanking down, and the door rattled upward, rusty track screeching protest. Tom turned on all his lights as the shell slid forward. Inside, towering stacks of paper blocked his way. There wasn't room to go between them. He shoved them, hard, but even as they started to collapse, it occurred to him that he could go above them. He pushed up toward the ceiling.
What the fuck?
One of the card players said when they heard the loading gate screech open. A heartbeat later, they were all moving. Both card players scrambled to their feet. One of them produced a gun. The man in the flannel shirt looked up from his scales. The fat man turned away from the shredder, shouting something, but it was impossible to make out what he was saying. Against the far wall, bales of paper came crashing down, knocking into neighboring stacks and sending them down too, in a chain reaction that spread across the warehouse. Without an instant's hesitation, Bannister went for Angel Face. Tack took his mind and stopped him in mid-stride, with his revolver half-drawn. And then a dozen bales of shredded paper slammed down against the rear of the forklift. The vehicle shifted just a little, crushing Tachyon's left hand under a huge black tire. He cried out in shock and pain, and lost Bannister. Down below, two little men were shooting at him. The first shot startled him so badly that Tom lost his concentration for a split second, and the shell dropped 4 feet before he got it back. Then the bullets were pinging harmlessly off his armor and ricocheting around the warehouse. Tom smiled.
"I am the great and powerful Turtle!"
he announced at full volume as stacks of paper crashed down all around.
"You assholes are up shit creek! Surrender now!"
The nearest asshole didn't surrender. He fired again, and one of Tom's screens went black.
"Oh, fuck!"
Tom said, forgetting to kill his mic. He grabbed the guy's arm and pulled the gun away, and from the way the jerk screamed, he'd probably dislocated his shoulder, too, goddammit. He'd have to watch that. The other guy started running, jumping over a collapsed pile of paper. Tom caught him in mid-jump, took him straight up to the ceiling, and hung him from a rafter. His eyes flicked from screen to screen, but one screen was dark now, and the damned vertical hold had gone again on the one next to it, so he couldn't make out a fucking thing to that side. He didn't have time to fix it. Some guy in a flannel shirt was loading bags into a suitcase. He saw on the big screen, and from the corner of his eye, he spied a fat guy climbing into a forklift. His hand crushed beneath the tire, Tachyon writhed in excruciating pain and tried not to scream. Bannister. Had to stop Bannister before he got to Angel Face. He ground his teeth together and tried to will away the pain, to gather it into a ball and push it from him the way he'd been taught. But it was hard. He'd lost the discipline. He could feel the shattered bones in his hand. His eyes were blurry with tears. And then he heard the forklift's motor turn over, and suddenly it was surging forward, rolling right up his arm, coming straight at his head, the tread of the massive tire a black wall of death rushing toward him, and passing an inch over the top of his skull as it took to the air. The forklift flew nicely across the warehouse and embedded itself in the far wall, with a little push from the great and powerful Turtle. The fat man dove off in midair and landed on a pile of coverless paperbacks. It wasn't until then that Tom happened to notice Tachyon lying on the floor under the place the forklift had been. He was holding his hand funny, and his chicken mask was all smashed up and dirty, Tom saw. And as he staggered to his feet, he was shouting something. He went running across the floor, reeling, unsteady. Where the fuck was he going in such a hurry? Frowning, Tom smacked the malfunctioning screen with the back of his hand, and the vertical roll stopped suddenly. For an instant, the image on the television was clear and sharp. A man in a raincoat stood over a woman on a mattress. She was real pretty, and there was a funny smile on her face, sad but almost accepting, as he pressed the revolver right up to her forehead. Tack came reeling around the shredding machine, his ankles all rubber, the world a red blur, his shattered bones jabbing against each other with every step, and found them there, Bannister touching her lightly with his pistol, her skin already darkening where the bullet would go in. And through his tears and his fears and a haze of pain, he reached out for Bannister's mind and seized it, just in time to feel him squeeze the trigger and wince as the gun kicked back in his mind. He heard the explosion from two sets of ears.
"No!"
he shrieked. He closed his eyes, sunk to his knees. He made Bannister fling the gun away for what good it would do. None at all. Too late. Again he'd come too late. Failed. Failed again. Angel Face, Blythe, his sister, everyone he loved, all of them gone. He doubled over on the floor and his mind filled with images of broken mirrors, of the wedding pattern danced in blood and pain. And that was the last thing he knew before the darkness took him. He woke to the astringent smell of a hospital room and the feel of a pillow under his head, the pillowcase crisp with starch. He opened his eyes.
"Des,"
he said weakly. He tried to sit, but he was bound up somehow. The world was blurry and unfocused.
"You're a traction doctor," Des said. "Your right arm was broken in two places, and your hand is worse than that."
"I'm sorry,"
Tack said. He would have wept, but he had run out of tears.
"I'm so sorry. We tried. I'm so sorry.
Tacky," she said in that soft, husky voice. And she was there, standing over him, dressed in a hospital gown, black hair framing a wry smile. She had combed it forward to cover her forehead. Beneath her bangs was a hideous purple-green bruise, and the skin around her eyes was red and raw. For a moment, he thought he was dead, or mad, or dreaming.
"It's all right, Tacky. I'm okay. I'm here."
He stared up at her numbly.
"You're dead," he said dully. "I was too late. I heard the shot. I had him by then, but he was too late. I felt the gun recoil in his hand."
"Did you feel it jerk?" she asked him.
"Jerk?"
"A couple of inches, no more. Just as he fired, just enough. I got some nasty powder burns, but the bullet went into the mattress a foot from my head."
"The turtle,"
Tack said hoarsely. She nodded. "He pushed aside the gun just as Bannister squeezed the trigger, and you made the son of a bitch throw away the revolver before he could get off a second shot."
"You got them," Dez said. "A couple of men escaped in the confusion, but the turtle delivered three of them, including Bannister, plus a suitcase packed with 20 pounds of pure heroin. And it turns out that the warehouse is owned by the Mafia."
"The Mafia?"
Tachyon said.
"The mob," Dez explained. "Criminals, Dr. Tachyon."
"One of the men captured in the warehouse has already turned state's evidence,"
Angel Face said.
"He'll testify to everything. The bribes, the drug operation, the murders at the funhouse."
"Maybe we'll even get some decent police in Jokertown,"
Dez added. The feelings that rushed through Tachyon went far beyond relief. He wanted to thank them, wanted to cry for them, but neither the tears nor the words would come. He was weak and happy.
"I didn't fail,"
he managed at last.
"No,"
Angel Face said. She looked at Dez.
"Would you wait outside?"
When they were alone, she sat on the edge of the bed.
"I want to show you something. Something I wish I'd shown you a long time ago."
She held it up in front of him. It was a gold locket.
"Open it."
It was hard to do with only one hand, but he managed. Inside was a small round photograph of an elderly woman in bed. Her limbs were skeletal and withered, sticks draped in mottled flesh, and her face was horribly twisted.
"What's wrong with her?"
Tack asked, afraid of the answer. Another joker, he thought, another victim of his failures. Angel Face looked down at the twisted old woman, sighed, and closed the locket with a snap.
"When she was 4, in Little Italy, she was run over while playing in the street. A horse stepped on her face, and the wagon wheel crushed her spine. That was in, 1886. She was completely paralyzed, but she lived. If you could call it living. That little girl spent the next 60 years in a bed, being fed, washed, and read to, with no company except the Holy Sisters. Sometimes all she wanted was to die. She dreamed about what it would be like to be beautiful, to be loved and desired, to be able to dance, to be able to feel things. Oh, how she wanted to feel things."
She smiled.
"I should have said thank you long ago, Tacky. But it's hard for me to show that picture to anyone. But I am grateful. And now I owe you doubly. You'll never pay for a drink at the funhouse."
He stared at her.
"I don't want a drink," he said. "No more. That's done."
And it was, he knew. If she could live with her pain, what excuse could he possibly have to waste his life and talents?
"Angel Face," he said suddenly, "I can make you something better than heroin. I am a biochemist. There are drugs on Tacky's. I can synthesize them, painkillers, nerve blocks. If you let me run some tests on you, maybe I can tailor something to your metabolism. I'll need a lab, of course. Setting things up will be expensive, but the drug could be made for pennies." "I'll have some money," she said. "I'm selling the funhouse to Dez. But what you're talking about is illegal."
"To hell with their stupid laws,"
Tack blazed.
"I won't tell if you won't."
Then words came tumbling out one after the other, a torrent. Plans, dreams, hopes, all of the things he'd lost or drowned in cognac and Sterno. And Angel Face was looking at him, astonished, smiling. And when the drugs they had given him finally began to wear off, and his arm began to throb again, Dr. Tachyon remembered the old disciplines and sent the pain away, and somehow it seemed as though part of his guilt and his grief went with it, and he was whole again and alive. The headline said, "Turtle, Tachyon, Smash Heroin Ring." Tom was gluing the article into the scrapbook when Joey returned with the beers.
"They left out the great and powerful part,"
Joey observed, setting down a bottle by Tom's elbow.
"At least I got first billing," Tom said.
He wiped thick white paste off his fingers with a napkin and shoved the scrapbook aside. Underneath were some crude drawings he'd made of the shell.
"Now," he said, "where the fuck are we going to put the record player, huh?"